Radio Hallam presents Chat-In with Elton John. Have you got a couple of hours spare, or how long can we chat for? Because this programme, each week, you see, we get a star name, and we chat for sometimes half an hour, a couple of hours. How long have you got?
I've got a couple of hours. A
couple of hours. Great. All right. We normally start at the beginning with people's career.
Right.
Can we be different this week?
Oh, yes, certainly.
It's just that fresh on my mind was a quote that I read the other day, which said that you yourself had generated approximately £50,000 worth of business into the record business over the last 5 years. This was in a story somewhere in America, I believe.
£50,000, is that all? In the last 5 years? God.
Generated was the word.
Generated? That's not much in 5 years. I should say it would be more in the million mark.
Really?
Yes.
You don't know where that quote came from?
No, it's one of those rubbishy remarks again. I'm supposed to have 6 yachts and 438 racehorses, which I haven't got, so I should say it's generally untrue.
Do you find that you're misquoted a lot?
Misquoted. I mean, they just don't bother to quote me anywhere. They just make it up, you know, which is a hazard, especially with the tax man coming saying, can I have a look at your yacht and your racehorses and your 3 houses in America? And you say, well, actually, I don't have them, yeah. They don't even bother to quote now. I read, actually, in William Hickey in the Daily Express that when Evel Knievel was going to jump on that rocket over that canyon, that I was by his side singing The Stars and Stripes, when in fact I was sitting in Wentworth in bed reading it in the Daily Express. So, you know, you're constantly amazed at what's written about you.
Do you actually ever follow them up afterwards and sort of get in touch with these people and say, look, wherever did you get this story from?
No, I don't bother, because, I mean, you can't. With journalists, you never have the last say. They can always have the last say. They can always get the paper out and print it the next day. So you never have the last words. I don't bother. And people say, oh, I thought you were in America. You know, you think, oh. It's like I was never leaving Britain and the News of the World printed the story saying Elton John gets ready to quit England, and actually the man quoted me very accurately, which said I wasn't leaving England, and then the headline was Elton John gets ready to quit. So I mean, it's rather confusing, really. I mean, the joke is that some of the public really believe it, and they say, oh, I think most people think I live in America, which I don't.
But you visit
occupational hazard, you know.
How often do you spend? How much time do you spend in America per year? Then
it differs. We used to record in France, so we never used to record in America. But now we record there. I suppose that takes up, for example, 2 months of the year, because we usually do 2 albums a year. And if we do a 10-week tour, I suppose we must spend about 4 months, 5 months of the year in America. But that's last year, and that's a pretty full year. This year, however, we're not doing a tour of America, I don't think. So the amount of time spent abroad will be considerably less.
Do you find the audiences, say, in New York on the East Coast, compared with Hollywood and where you did that amazing concert in the Hollywood Bowl, comparatively different in approach to recognising you as a British artist?
No, I mean, they all seem to think I'm British. There is a difference, I think, between East Coast and West Coast audiences in the fact that the East Coast ones are crazier than the West Coast. The West Coast ones are more laid back. But I think, you know, I think both of them recognise me as an English artist. There's no confusion over there. There's confusion over here. A lot of people still don't think I'm English, you know, which is ridiculous.
You're joking.
No.
What
no,
sort of people? English people, well, or American?
Yeah, English people still think I'm American, you know.
Why?
I don't know. It's probably because they read in the paper that I, you know, spend a lot of time over there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I got my initial success there. A lot of people still, you wouldn't believe it, but it's true. I mean, we did a tour, for example, just to illustrate the point, we did a tour with Derek and the Dominoes way back, about 3 or 4 years ago, when Eric Clapton was Derek and the Dominoes. And people didn't come to see him because they didn't know it was Eric Clapton. And you think people read, they're not like us, they don't read trade papers and newspapers every week. So they don't get informed very well. As a fact, when we put Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds out in the States, I thought, well, I mean, I've got to, you know, play it on stage, people go mad. The half of them hadn't heard it, because it's not revered in the States, Sergeant Pepper, as it is over here. So it's very strange. What you think and what people know about are two different things.
Well, that's just dealing with America. I mean, you've done Australia and New Zealand and places around the world. Is that even more confusing when you travel further afield?
It is in Japan. No, they seem to get... They're very, very well informed in Australia and New Zealand. They've got nothing else to do over there, really, I suppose. They're sort of in the middle of nowhere. No, they're very, very well informed. Japan, it's a problem because hardly anybody speaks English. So you go to Japan, it's like 3 weeks touring in a monastery because you just end up by talking to yourself for 3 weeks. It's very enjoyable. The people are tremendous. But hardly anyone speaks English out of Tokyo.
Do your records sell over there, then?
Oh, yeah. Huh? I mean, I would say that they sell very, very well over there.
In English?
Yeah, in English. Yeah. Oh, yes.
But can I understand what you're singing about?
I don't know. They seem to know the words and things like that. At the concerts, they will sing, oh, goodbye, yalla, record, Lord, and Loy Lodgers and things like that. No, they you see, the big market in Japan, actually, the things that sell most in Japan are middle-of-the-road music. People like Henry Mancini and James Last sell album upon album, and rock music is beginning to sort of sell more albums all the time. But people like the Carpenters sell absolute, and Simon and Garfunkel. The mind boggles how much they sell in Japan.
Mm-hmm. So your ballads have tended to sell.
Yeah,
well,
they like the slow ones. In fact, when we first went to Japan, I had a hit with a single called It's Me That You Need, which was my second or third single over here. It was a big flop over here. And I hadn't played it since that. I mean, since it came out. And 3 or 4 years later, here we are in Japan. And it's the record's in the top 10, so we had to get a copy of it to learn it and relearn the words and play it. So that was my biggest chart success in Japan. It was a flop everywhere else in the world.
Going back to America just for a moment, a journalist in one of the newspapers over there, you say you don't read the trade papers, did you?
Oh, I do, yeah, but not everybody else does.
Well, you probably remember exactly what he said, attempting to pin down the extent of success of Elton John's current North American tour. He's talking about 1974, incidentally. It's a futile exercise in jaded hyperbole. Big words, aren't they? All of the traditional licks that rock writers so frequently use to describe an SRO situation. Fantastic, out of sight, incredible, far out, red hot, ridiculous, monstrous, unbelievable, sensational, dynamic, tremendous, have been battered to impotency in the acres of print, excess of recent time, so to point where none of them is really effective when applied to the 1974 Elton John tour, which might correctly be termed the most successful North American tour ever by a British artist. What exactly is he trying to say?
Well, actually, I wrote that. every tour that goes out that does well in the States is now acclaimed the biggest money spinner. I don't know what it's all about. I think it was one of the biggest tours of the States last year, alongside the Dylan tour and the Crosby, Stills and Nash tour. And Zeppelin's tour at the moment, and Jethro Tull out there too. Everyone, you know, goes over and does very well like that. People like Zeppelin and Tull are enormous. But it's just another, you know, they're probably after the advertising.
Do you find that when Americans come up to you, they immediately, I know your Elton John and the Beatles were four as such, but you're immediately compared with the last big success of Great Britain, which were, of course, the Beatles, and now you're a phenomenon over there, that you are compared with?
Yeah, they sound the Beatles of the 70s, which I could never quite see, but that's what they do say. I never believe it, you know. I just thought they're much cooler in America, though. I mean, people in general are much cooler. They don't rush up to you and go, oh, Elton John, which they do over here. You can be shopping, say, in Harrods in London and be weighed down with shopping and somebody will come up and say, can I have your autograph? I haven't got any paper and I haven't got a pen, but can I have your autograph? And you have to put it all down and get a paper and pencil and all this. But in America, they wouldn't do that.
And normally in Britain, they say, it's not for me.
It's not for a mother-in-law, you know, if she collects them.
Talking about music, which we weren't, it's basically called chatting, but we'd like to illustrate your incredible career by a few gramophone cylinders, if we may.
That's when I started in the 70s.
Yes. Going back a few years now, I think around about 1969, wasn't it, when we first heard you in the British, on British radio anyway as such?
Right, I think Lady Samantha was the first thing. Before we made an album, Lady Samantha was the single that sort of began to turn the tide before we made the Empty Sky album, which was a dismal flop when it came out. From Lady Samantha, It's Me That You Need was the next single, which again was a dismal flop. And then we changed producers from Steve Brown to Gus Dudgeon and planned the Elton John album with Paul Buckmaster doing the arrangements. And we had by this time we had a huge stockpile of material. And we just decided to divide the material up into two albums, one which all the stuff that appeared on Elton John and the other stuff appeared on Tumbleweed. So the two albums were quickly recorded soon after each other. Elton John was done first, and then we went back into the studios about 2 or 3 months after we finished that and did Tumbleweed.
Which studios, if we may ask?
Trident in London, Trident Studios. And the Elton John album was done live in a week. All the tracks were done live except for the vocals. And there's hardly no overdubs on it. It was all done live. I was petrified playing with all those string players who could sort of sit there and read the newspaper and then just pick up the sheet music and play it straight off. So I had to sort of learn my parts straight, you know. Very frightening experience, but it was a big budget then. It was made for £7,000 an album, which at that time, for me, was a lot of money to spend on making an album because I hadn't had any success to date.
Mm. Before Lady Samantha, how long had you been working with the Dick James organisation?
I'd say about 3 years, I think. Bernie and I had been trying to write hit songs for other people, and we'd recorded other things ourselves, which were dreadful. There actually was a record out before Lady Samantha, which I didn't even talk about.
And he's not going
to. A collector's item. About 3 years, very unsuccessful writing, you know, trying to write top 40 songs for Cilla Black and Tom Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And we were dreadful at it, absolutely awful. Yeah, couldn't do it. We tried. It's very hard to write those sort of songs. You've got to be a craftsman to do that as well as write. Yeah. But no matter how we tried, they just got worse.
Well, let's take two tracks now from the album Empty Sky, and straight after that, can we have an attitude to you about Bernie, how, in fact, you teamed up, etc.
Okay.
All right. Empty Sky, then, from that album, we'll have two tracks. One called Empty Sky, the title track, followed by a delightful song, Skyline Pigeon.
Thank you. days. But no man ever flies from this place. Yeah. Hey, the lucky locket hangs around your precious neck. Some luck I ever got with you, and I wouldn't like to bet.
Oh, Just let me wake up in the morning to the smell of newborn hay, to laugh and cry, to live and die in the brightness of my day. I wanna hear the pealing bells of distant churches sing, but most of all, please free me from this aching metal ring and open out this cage towards the sun. For just this skyline pigeon dreaming of the open, waiting for the day he can spread his wings and fly.
Tremendous sound. Skyline Pigeon from the year 1969, which was preceded, I think that's the word, anyway, it came before it, Empty Sky. 8 minutes, no less, of Elton's first album that you say was an amazing miss, did you say?
Yeah, the first album he made, Empty Sky, when it first came out, initially did 2,000 copies and that was it. It got very good reviews. In fact, it got very good reviews. But it just didn't sell a copy. Above 2,000, and but now it's sold quite a few as a result of the other albums being successful now. I still like it. I've got a very soft spot for it because it's the first album. You're very excited about first albums, but it just didn't do anything at all.
I was looking at a paper the other day, a stateside chart thing, and was I right or am I wrong, or am I right or am I wrong in saying that it's in the charts in America at the moment?
It's number five at this moment, going upwards. We put it out. They wanted to put it out, the company in America, for a long time. And we've always had so much stuff in the can and we've never been able to put it out. So I didn't really want to issue it as another Elton John album. I just wanted to put it out in inconspicuously, as it were, so that people wouldn't be sort of think it was a new album. So after Christmas, MCA Records in America did a big Elton John campaign on the albums that I'd already had out and a sort of catalogue push. And they just included Empty Sky in it, but there was no advertisement for it. No one was sent a copy to the radio stations, because most people have got it on import in all the radio stations anyway. So we haven't had an advert or we haven't sent it to anybody, and there's been no radio spots for it. So it's got there to number five without anything, without, you know, because I just didn't want it overhyped, because I didn't want people to think it was a new Elton John album.
You're very modest young lad, aren't you?
Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
So let's get on to, as I think I said about 14 minutes ago, about Bernie Taupin, how you met up with him and how you got the songwriting thing together.
Well, actually, I was in a group backing Long John Baldry, and I was getting increasingly fed up with playing places like Sheffield Bailey's Club.
You haven't been here before. You actually have.
Cavendish Club, actually, it was called in those days. And I spent Christmas in Sheffield doing Cavendish Club. And then we went up to South Shields and played South Shields Latino. This was at the time that he's had this big hit record with Let the Heartaches Begin. And I thought, oh, I don't want to. After 5 years in an unsuccessful professional group, I was getting to the end of my tether. And it was all getting very uncreative.
What were you doing with Long John?
Just playing piano for him, really. I enjoyed working with him because he was a tremendous bloke and a lot of fun to work, very unpredictable person to work for. But I decided that while I was in the group, I'd look around for something to get out, you know, to do. So Liberty Records at the time were used to be issued by EMI Records, and they went independent. And they moved to Albemarle Street in London. And they put an advert in the New Musical Express saying, "Talent wanted, idiots, phone up me." And I wrote a letter saying, "I am presently involved in a group and could possibly write songs, but need lyric writer." So I went in and had an interview with Ray Williams at Liberty Records. And he introduced not introduced me to Bernie, just said, there's somebody who sent some lyrics down, take them home and see what you think of them. And that was it, really. And so I started writing all these songs while I was still with the group. And eventually, through I got turned down by Liberty Records, and they didn't want to sign me as a songwriter. So I went to Dick James Music and signed, actually, for a contract with Gralto, which was the Hollies musical publishing company. And the first songs that we actually wrote were published by Gralto. Graham Allen and Tony, that's what it stood for. And eventually, Dick James signed us to a contract because Gralto weren't really doing anything with our songs. And when we sort of guaranteed 10 quid a week wage, I left the band. And I stayed with the band right up to the point where I had a guaranteed wage coming in.
What, literally 10 quid?
Yeah, that was it. 10 quid a week. But I used to supplement it by starting to do sessions on piano and backing vocals and things like that. I used to start doing session work. But at first it was just 10 quid. But I was so relieved. 10 quid was like... living at home, it wasn't so bad. If I had been living away from home, it would have been harder. But it was great to just get out of the band and do something I wanted to do.
Is there any rumour in the truth that you gigged on the Hollies' He Ain't Heavy track?
Yeah, I played piano, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of sessions. I can't remember half the ones I did.
Daughter of
Darkness.
Tom Jones.
Yes. Mike Samson. All those. I did Frank Chaxfield albums.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Frank Chaxfield.
I did Mike. You know, like choral work on Mike Sam singers type things. Mind-boggling it was. It was a very good experience. Because I started to do cover versions of other people's songs, and that was fun too. Just to supplement my wage, my £10 a week, really, that was all it was. In fact, I was doing a lot of session work before I went on the road as Elton John. I was doing quite a lot of session work.
What was that funny noise? Where did that come from? You have to edit that out. The first biggie you had on DJM was your song, correct?
No, it was Hattie Jakes.
Yes, folks, biggie. Yes.
No,
we haven't got any applause, unfortunately. Can't afford applause out here.
Oh, it's that soup, isn't it?
Was that right or wrong? What was the question?
The question is, the first biggie that you had on DJM was Hattie Jakes.
Right.
No, it was your song.
Was it?
Yes.
Well, it's surprising to hear that. You wrote that with Bernie.
I did indeed.
And
actually, we made the Elton John album. We thought it was going to be a mind-boggling album. We were very pleased with it, and we thought... that it would come out to acclaim, which it did get. It got critical acclaim, but it didn't sell. It came in at 45 in the Music Week chart or whatever it was and disappeared the next week and sold initially about the same amount of copies as Empty Sky had done.
2,000.
At much higher cost. So I had eventually, all this time I sort of stayed away from going on the road again. And after the dismal failure of the Elton John album when it came out, I more or less had to get a band on the road because you couldn't sell albums without going on the road. So I had to do it. I had to get it together, which I wasn't very keen on at first. But once I had a couple of rehearsals, it was all right. We started to do gigs, and that helped us a lot. So, but in fact, the Your Song wasn't a hit until I'd come back from America and had an initial success over there, and it was a hit around about the end of 1970.
I see now that it's still being covered by different artists. There's a reggae version out, isn't there, Mendel, or coming out soon by The Fortunes?
Someone told me there's a reggae version coming out by The Fortunes, and it's been it's one of my most recorded songs. It gets recorded quite a lot. It's been done by the Andy Williams and Lena Horne and all those people. And in fact, one of the luckiest things that ever happened to us was we were on the B-side of Me and Mrs. Jones by Billy Paul, which happened to sell about 3.5 million copies in America. And I put it on my jukebox after doing an American tour and looked at the B-side and your song, E. John Beethoven. My God, we're rich.
Do you get a percentage being on the B-side?
You get the same amount as a writer as you do on the A-side, yeah, except that you don't get a writer gets paid for the amount of times his record's played on the radio.
Mm.
But for actual sales, you get the same rate, yeah. So we were quite happy about it.
That's how it works, is it?
Yes.
Because a lot of people write in and say all this performing rights stuff, they don't quite understand. Every time somebody comes into a studio and we play a record and we say, you're not getting a penny for it if they haven't written the song, but if they have written the song, they get whatever, yeah. XP. But they don't, in fact, as a writer, get anything on the B-side. They just pick up the tabs from the sales.
From the sales, right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You wrote this one. We're going to play it on the radio. You do the A-side of your song, do you do the B-side?
Did I do the B-side?
I mean, did you write it?
The Beatles, oh yeah, we were writing everything at this point. I mean, nobody could get a look in. I mean, we were very selfish. No, yes, we wrote the B-side. The B-side actually was called Into the Old Man's Shoes, which is very interesting.
We're not going to play that, unfortunately.
No, no.
We're going to play your song, all right?
Yes, quite right.
Here it comes.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no. Or a man who makes potions in a traveling show. I know it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. Tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind that I put down the words how wonderful life is while you're in. Sun's been quite kind while I wrote this song. It's for people like you that keep it turned on. So excuse me for getting, but these things I do, you see, I've forgotten if they're green or they're blue. You're in the world. I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind that I put down in the world how wonderful life is while you're in the
Your song from Elton John. You're tuned to Radio Hallam. We'll be back in just a couple of moments' time. Welcome back. This is the sound of Radio Hallam, 194 metres in the medium wave, 95.2 megahertz VHF stereo from Sheffield, 95.9 megahertz VHF stereo from Rotherham. It's chatting with Elton John. Trying to keep a straight face. It's unbelievable. He's doing all sorts of naughty things to make you laugh. He's supping tea at the moment. Anyway, that's all we can afford, I'm afraid, Radio Hallam, on a Sunday afternoon, Elton, is a cup of tea.
Actually, I was chipping Sudbury.
Chipping what?
Sudbury.
This makes a change from Morton in the Marsh, I suppose.
You remember.
I remember it well. Yes, but we're jumping. That was 19...
you made it, but I'm sitting down.
Stop it! Which brings us to 1970, it says here on this carefully rehearsed and well-written ad lib. 1970 was a good year for you because you did an album called Tumbleweed Connection. You also visited America for the very first time as a pop artist.
Right, well, by this time we started to go on the road, Dee Murray, Nigel Olsen and myself, as a three-piece suit, or a suite, or a band. And we'd been doing it. We did about 25 gigs in England, and we, you know, begin to play. The album sales begin to sort of increase gradually, and we went down very well everywhere we played. And Dick got a cable from Uni Records, which is MCA in America, who were going to put out the Elton John album, and said, would Elton come over and play the Troubadour if we fixed it up? And because we think that we could break the album, it's got a great critical response, and we think we could break Elton John as a result of playing the Troubadour. I was very sceptical about it. I thought, well, how are they going to... going to break me from a place that holds 350 people in Los Angeles? How they expect the record to sell in Detroit, you know? So anyway, I was very unwilling to go, really. I really went just to sort of see what record shops were like in America. But we went over and we played the Troubadour Club, and it was amazing. The record started just to leap up the charts, and not just in Los Angeles, but everywhere. And we were really a hit in America as a result of playing on the West Coast in one club that held 350 people. Rather strange, really. And I can say no more about it.
I thought you did very well that time around, yes.
Yes.
There's an amazing record shop, isn't there, right near the Troubadour?
It's Tower Records on Sunset
right.
Strip. Yeah, it's the best record
I've
shop.
I've never seen a shop like that anywhere in the world.
It's not
got
even,
everything.
It's got stacks and stacks of everything. I go then there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they open it specially for me now, and they open at 10, so I can have 2 hours to rummage without being pestered by stoned freaks saying, "Hey man, I really dug your last record," so I can rummage around the old. They got some amazing spoken word records in there, and they've even got a few of Cliff Richard's records in it too.
Cliff.
Cliff, yeah, no, they've got amazing English section, all the Goon records, everything.
Mm. I found actually in that particular place, I'd written some sleeve notes when I used to work for the other lot, the Beeb, on a group called Vanity Fair, and I didn't even know I'd written the sleeve notes, and I found
well,
it
we won't hold it against you.
No, in fact, it'd be very dangerous if you did. Can we have a track from Tumbleweed Connection?
Yeah, I'm going to play a... excuse me, I've got a cold. I can't remember what we're going to play now.
A Ballad of a Well-Known...
Oh, Ballad of a Well-Known Gun. We're going to play that. Let it run rubbish. No, we'll play Ballad of a Well-Known Gun because at this time, still, I wasn't recording with Dee and Nigel. In fact, they did appear on one track on Tumbleweed called Amarina. But I was mostly recording with session people and using Hookfoot, Caleb Quay and Roger Pope and Roger Glover to do my backtracks for, which is very strange because Gus wasn't sure about using Nigel and Dee. So at this point, I was still using more or less friends and not the band. So this is one with Hookfoot on it, which is really funky.
And this is how it goes.
Thank you.
ballad of a pretty well-known somebody or other from the Tumbleweed Connection LP, starring Elton John in the lead role.
Thank you.
And an assorted musicians various, I gather.
Yeah, it was just a mishmash of musicians, mostly Hookfoot, and as I say, Dee and Nigel on one track, and lots of bad. Dusty sang on one track on backing vocals on My Father's Gun, and on that track, actually, you just heard. So I was very... But this time, I was knocked out. Dusty Springfield, who was my childhood idol, had actually come and sung on one of my records. I couldn't believe it. And in fact, on Tumbleweed, we did Love Song, Leslie Duncan,
mm-hmm.
Which had been out as a B-side of a record called Road to Nowhere. And it was the B-side to that, and I found it on the B-side, and I was so knocked out with it. I asked her if I could do it on the album, and she said, "Of course, Jim." And we did we did it together on the album. And actually, it's rather a strange track, because there's a sort of noise like a scratch on the record. In fact, droves of people took their records back, thinking there was a scratch on it, where in fact it was my foot tapping.
Really?
How interesting.
I'm glad you mentioned
really,
that.
It really happened, but people took the album back, the four that bought it, and said, "There's a scratch on this record." And in fact, it was my foot tapping on it. It doesn't really sound like a foot, you see.
Sounds like a scratch, presumably.
And I'm not a mine of information, I am.
How can you do a, for instance, you know, a sort of an imaginary scratch now? How do you achieve a scratch by doing whatever you do with
your
foot?
Well, you have to get special lino or wooden floor and just tap your foot. But it sounded like a scratch. How interesting. How many people can write in and find out if it was a scratch or not? Now, it's very hard to... I mean, when Legs Larry Smith danced on one of my songs, Reminisce, Reminisce, Wobble, Waffle, Waffle, I can remember when he brought his own floor with him. No, he did. The collapsible floor. And walked into Trident with his floor and tap danced on it and walked out again. Very hard to record noises like that.
Next week, folks, Elton John will be having a juggler, no doubt. Next week, LP after... The Tumbleweed job was called Madman Across the Water.
Yes.
Any madman in particular?
No, actually, there's a story. That's funny you should mention that. After Madman came Honky Chateau, and I was... People in America are always reading things into things that aren't there, you see. And one very stone person got to me and said, "Oh, man, I really got off in the fact that after Madman Across the Water, which was, of course, Richard Nixon, you put an album out called Honky Chateau, which means White House. I thought that was really cool." And I thought, oh, what is he talking about? He's a fool. The man's an idiot. I mean, they're always coming out and saying things like that in the States. Elton John, meet Barry Bucknell next week. Build your own record store.
Madman Across the Water.
Yes.
Any particular track?
This is the first album that I began to use Dee and Nigel a bit more. Davey Johnson actually came down and did a couple of sessions for us on Holiday and Madman Across the Water itself, that track. But I'm going to play a track called Razorface because it had Jack Emblow. Now, this is on accordion.
Unbelievable. Not the Jack Emblow.
Music while you work, Jack Emblow. I mean, we wanted an accordionist, and he was fantastic. He was really good. And Rick Wakeman played organ on it because I'm the world's worst organ player, next to Sweep. And I sort of like this song anyway.
And it says here on this piece of paper you just handed me, it was recorded on the 9th of August, 1971. Can I quote that?
Yes, you can.
Right. Razorface. You.
Needs a man.